Missoula police have arrested a suspect in connection to a rape at the University of Montana. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us an initiative trying to expand Medicaid in the state is one step closer to being placed on the ballot. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a husband and wife team who produced a documentary featuring three young people from the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. Missoula police have made an arrest in connection to a report of a recent rape at the University of Montana's Mountain Campus in Missoula. Detective Sergeant Travis Welsh with the Missoula Police Department says the alleged incident unfolded this past weekend.
We received information at about 8:15 p.m. Monday night that a woman had reported having been raped in her dormitory room on the University of Montana campus very early that morning. The University Office of Public Safety had responded and then subsequently requested assistance from the university or from the Missoula Police Department, and the case has now been transferred to the city for additional follow-up.
The woman who filed the report was able to identify her alleged attacker, and Welsh says an arrest has been made.
They were acquaintances, though it seemed like they had met just recently. At the very least, I think I could say that they were brief acquaintances.
The Missoulian newspaper identifies the suspect as 18-year-old Timothy Schwartz. Welsh says this particular investigation came together rather rapidly.
Some things fell into place, and I wouldn't count on this happening for every case. Obviously, it doesn't. But things seemed to work out well this time, enough for us to at least be able to remove a potential threat from the community.
Welsh says the Missoula County Attorney's Office will review the case and make any charging decisions.
As we reported last week, the U.S. Department of Justice issued a letter describing problems in the Missoula County Attorney's Office's response to sexual assault, including there is a substantial evidence that the office's response discriminates against women. Details from that letter include a prosecutor allegedly telling a woman whose 5-year-old daughter was assaulted by a young man, quote, "Boys will be boys," when she asked why the person had been sentenced for 2 years of community service. County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg has denied the allegations, saying the letter is, quote, "full of mistruths, half-truths, and outright lies." Care2, an online community that says it has more than 23 million members and serves as a springboard for activism on a variety of issues, has created an online petition asking Van Valkenburg to cooperate with the DOJ. Care2's Emily Logan created the petition. Logan says she hopes it will prompt Van Valkenburg to implement the DOJ's recommendations.
Just realize that, you know, not only, you know, people from Montana really care about this and really want them to be taken seriously, but, you know, people from all over the country and even some people outside of the country. And, you know, I mean, I really think that, you know, part of the reason we decided to start this petition, it just seems like the Department of Justice coming in, making these recommendations and doing this investigation, really to say that they don't have jurisdiction, you know, is really just kind of missing the point. There's obviously a trend here, obviously a pattern. You know, at least take the recommendations seriously and the investigation seriously, and then, you know, implement as many of the recommendations as possible, because this is a really serious issue for so many Montana women.
Logan adds this isn't the first petition Care2 has created in Montana related to sexual assault. They also filed one in response to the sentence given to Stacey Rambold by Montana Judge G.T. Baugh.
We had a petition go absolutely wild on our site about that issue. People just really, really cared about it. It's got, I believe, 122,000 signatures, something like that, 121,700 on Care2. And so, you know, it's just really obvious that people want sexual assault and sexual abuse to be taken seriously. And it's clear that there have been a number of cases in Montana specifically where that just doesn't seem to be the case.
So far, the petition asking Van Valkenburg to cooperate with the DOJ has a little more than 4,700 signatures.
And in other news from around the state, supporters of an initiative looking to expand Medicaid in the state can now begin gathering signatures to place the measure on the November ballot. The Attorney General's office approved the Healthy Montana plan this week after finding problems with earlier versions of the initiative. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says opponents still believe the measure violates the state constitution.
Any initiative brought by the people goes through the Attorney General's office before backers can begin gathering signatures for it. the office makes sure it follows all laws governing how ballot issues must be submitted. Attorney General Tim Fox says the Healthy Montana initiative has passed that scrutiny, so Secretary of State Linda McCullough says voters can now sign petitions.
They would need 24,175 verified signatures.
5% of Montana voters, and they have until June 20th to get that many.
June 20th at 5 p.m.
We're one step closer to accepting federal funds that were meant to be invested in Montana and that should be invested in Montana.
That's Kim Abbott.
I'm president of the Healthy Montana Initiative.
Expanding the Medicaid program is an optional piece of the federal Affordable Care Act. In Montana, it would extend coverage to an estimated 80,000 low-income people. The program would be almost entirely federally funded for about the first year and a half, but the state share of the expense would grow over time. The Montana legislature voted last year against the expansion, so this initiative would put that decision before Montana voters if the signatures can be gathered in time. Abbott admits they don't have as much time as they'd hoped.
Yeah, we needed to refile over a disagreement that we had about the law.
Remember from earlier, the attorney general is supposed to check if the initiative follows all the laws for initiatives. Well, one of the main rules says initiatives cannot appropriate money. That's from the state constitution. Initiatives cannot spend state money. Only the legislature can do that. An earlier version of the Healthy Montana plan would have been effective upon passing, so in November. That would start spending money for Medicaid expansion before the 2015 legislature meets. Attorney General Tim Fox says, hey, you can't do that. So this most recent version, the one that's been approved, it would become effective summer 2015, with the expectation lawmakers would approve the funding next January. Again, Kim Abbott.
What this does is show the clear will of the people of Montana. If they go to the polls and they vote for the Healthy Montana Initiative, the legislature then gets to take a hard look at that new statute and decide whether to accept those federal funds.
But those opposed to the measure say they still believe it's unconstitutional. Bozeman lawyer and Republican House candidate Matthew Monfortin believes the proposal would still force the legislature to spend the money.
So even if the legislature says we're not going to supply any of the funding that this initiative is called for, it will be a matter of state law that those added Medicaid expenditures have to be made.
So that aspect of the initiative could still end up in court eventually. Meanwhile, Monfortin has himself drafted another initiative which would stop any state funding of the Affordable Care Act. That measure is still waiting for approval from the Attorney General's office. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
A Montana legislator who is defending himself against allegations that he took illegal corporate contributions has filed to run for another term. Republican Representative Mike Miller of Helmville filed with the Montana Secretary of State's office today to run for the House District 80. Last month, Commissioner of Political Practices Jonathan Modell lodged a civil action against Miller in the state court. Modell is asking a judge to uphold his findings that Miller took illegal contributions from and illegally coordinated with the secretive conservative group Western Tradition Partnership in 2010. If upheld, Miller could be barred from holding or running for office. He has denied any wrongdoing. Miller did not immediately return a call for comment. He previously said if he didn't run, it would appear he let Modell drive him out of office.
U.S. Senator John Tester says he'll use his new role as chairman of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee to target wasteful spending, improve educational opportunities, and promote job development on reservations. The Montana lawmaker visited the Crow Indian Reservation today with fellow Democratic Senator John Walsh. The pair toured a Head Start education center after a breakfast meeting with tribal leaders. Tester says dysfunction within agencies overseeing the nation's 566 recognized tribes is draining money from crucial programs, including health care and education. He also says too many bureaucratic roadblocks hinder tribes trying to become self-reliant, such as the Crow's attempts to increase coal mining. But Tester says he'll tread carefully to avoid infringing on the sovereignty of West Coast tribes opposed to coal export terminals in Washington and Oregon.
Ravalli County commissioners have decided to file a lawsuit seeking $29,000 in fines from the interim county treasurer for failing to complete 58 financial reports over a three-month period. Meanwhile, Valerie Stamey, who is on paid administrative leave, said she was filing a lawsuit yesterday alleging an auditor hired by the county libeled her for reporting that duties of the treasurer were not properly executed, the treasurer's office was in disarray, and nearly $1 million in deposits hadn't been made. The clerk of court's office said this morning the lawsuit had not been filed. Stamey was placed on leave on January 23rd after falling months behind on depositing money and providing disbursements in financial reports. 2 days earlier, she had alleged the county's books were a mess when she was appointed in September.
A medical device manufacturer with offices in California and Washington has agreed to pay the federal government up to $5.25 million to resolve allegations that it instructed doctors to overcharge federal health care programs for a procedure using their device. The U.S. Justice Department announced the settlement with Endogastric Solutions today. It resolves a whistleblower lawsuit filed in Montana by former employee Glenn Schmossau, who will receive up to $945,000. Endogastric created the Esophix as a less invasive way to treat gastric reflux. The government alleged the company told healthcare providers to bill for the procedure using codes that apply to a more invasive and more expensive procedure. Endogastric Solutions says it does not admit any wrongdoing in the settlement.
The U.S. Air Force is moving forward with its proposal to expand a bomber training site, most of which is over southeastern Montana. The Federal Aviation Administration notified the State Department of Transportation yesterday that it was taking public comment through April 3rd on the proposed expansion of the Powder River Training Complex. The Billings Gazette reports the extended training airspace would stretch about 300 miles between Billings and Bismarck, North Dakota, with the majority of the airspace being over southeastern Montana. The training site would also include land in northeastern Wyoming and parts of North and South Dakota. The Air Force says it needs the expansion to better train airplane crews to ensure their readiness to succeed and survive in combat. Some ranchers and private pilots in Montana oppose the expansion.
A Roman Catholic high school in Billings isn't renewing the contract of an assistant softball coach because she took a job at Planned Parenthood. Tarnduff told the Billings Gazette that Billings Central head coach Coleman Rockwell informed her Monday morning that she would not be helping with the team this spring. She received about $1,500 for coaching hitters and outfielders during last season. Catholic Schools Superintendent Patrick Haggerty says he agreed with the recommendation not to offer Duff a contract for this season. He said Planned Parenthood violates Catholic moral teachings by providing abortions. Duff began working as a clinical assistant at Planned Parenthood in November. She says her work involves pulling charts and scheduling appointments. In January, Butte Central Catholic Schools fired a pregnant, unmarried teacher.
A Great Falls man has been convicted of beating his girlfriend's 2-year-old son, causing injuries, including a ruptured pancreas, that were treated at a Seattle hospital. Yesterday, a jury convicted 21-year-old Riley Charlo Whitworth of aggravated assault, criminal endangerment, and assault on a minor for the January 2013 assault. Sentencing is set for March 26th. Prosecutors say Charlo Whitworth was left caring for the boy while his then-girlfriend Alex Paul worked. Charlo Whitworth admitted to police that he assaulted the toddler, but later recanted, saying he was lying to protect Paul. Paul, who is 20, has pleaded guilty to felony criminal endangerment for failing to seek immediate medical care for her son. The Great Falls Tribune reports the young boy is now in his father's custody in St. Ignatius. Dylan Evans says his son made a full recovery.
A documentary featuring three young people from the Blackfeet Indian Reservation, all at a crossroads in their lives, debuts this weekend at Missoula's Big Sky Documentary Film Festival.
I always want to be here. I want it to be right here where it started and never die. And so that my kids will have a good place and they'll be proud of where they're from. And that when they step out their door, when they go for a drive and step out the door onto the ground, they say, my grandpa was here once, or my great-great-great-great-grandpa was here once, you know. Because my great-great-great-great-grandpa was here probably once. Probably walked through this very spot. If not, he was up there. The chief. That's why it's very important to keep our old ways. Because if they lose it, then they lose all this.
Where God Likes to Be was directed and produced by husband and wife team Anna and Nico Hudak. Anna's from Germany and Nico's from Kalispell. The couple met and fell in love in New Zealand about 11 years ago. She was studying journalism and he was learning about film production. They eventually had to return to their native countries, but reconnected here in Montana during the winter of 2002. An intense February snowstorm left them stranded in Browning during that visit. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Nico explains that's how and where the idea for Where God Likes to Be was originally hatched.
Did I read this, that you were maybe hesitant to stay in Browning at first, and then Anna was like, no, we're here, let's stay?
Right. I think that's a really classic example of those mindsets, stereotypes that you're brought up with that we're all sort of sculpted into. Her coming from a German background, the romantic idea of Native Americans, and me coming from Kalispell with this sort of like, don't go to Browning, you know, God, there's nothing going on there, and if anything, it's dangerous, you know?
What'd you see? Who'd you meet?
We stayed in some motel, funky motel, on Main Street, and we were looking for something to eat, but we went to the supermarket, nothing there, we're both vegetarians, right? Just frozen meat and potato chips, and then we ended up at Subway, got a veggie sandwich, and the guy behind the counter was like this classic big Blackfeet guy with, you know, long braids, and he said, oh, where are you guys from? I said, oh, I'm just from Kalispell, and he looked at Anna and said, where are you from? She said, I'm from Germany, and he just went, what the hell are you doing in Browning? Super nice guy, though. And all of a sudden, I was like, wow. And then we just chatted for a while because there's nothing else. It's, you know, dumping snow and nothing going on. So we chatted with this guy for half an hour or something. Mm-hmm. And that was just kind of the first spark of, like, my perspective of Indian reservations in general is in need of
fine-tuning.
Yeah. Or just a more exploration there.
Still, though, it's a long way from Subway in the winter storm, you're stuck in Browning, to 12 years later, this film that's going to make its world premiere.
We lived in New Zealand for 7 years, and this film is kind of inspired by that observation of living in a country where the indigenous culture has a strong place in the popular culture and in the white culture, in the Pakeha culture, that's what the whites are called.
Maori?
Maori, right. And I think, you know, thinking about that, living in New Zealand, and sort of wishing that I had had that growing up in Kalispell. You know, I wish that I had learned some Blackfeet words or some Salish Kootenai words or, I mean, even just had any glimpse into that, what that culture was like. And we finished our studies in New Zealand and moved to Germany and lived there for a couple of years too. And Anna was working as a journalist and just got tired of it, and we decided that we had been talking about this film for a long time and we should actually just go make it. And that was in 2005.
Well, your film, Where God Likes to Be, introduces us to three young people, Andy Running Wolf, Doug Fitzgerald, and Edward Tailfeathers. I thought of him as the brainiac, Doug as the cowboy, and Andy is this adventurous young woman who just wanted to explore outside her immediate realm, the reservation. Why them? How did you get connected?
We came to the Flathead Valley and said, okay, we're gonna try to make this film, and what do we want to do? We want to do something that's more contemporary, right? We want to see what's going on in the minds of younger people. We don't want to make a historic film. And so we went through some contacts that were given to us through the FECC, and then a woman who's from Browning who works here, and then we ended up meeting a woman named Patty LaPlante, who said, you have to meet Darnell and Smokey Rides at the Door. They're spiritual leaders in the community, and they are involved in the high school, and they can point you in the right direction. And they gave us some names. We met with, you know, more than just Andy, Doug, and Eddie. We decided these three kind of fit just their personalities and their life goals and who they were.
Yeah, three very different people, but somehow they all work together in this one piece.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that was the most important thing, is that we showed different sides of this this story, you know, growing up on a reservation.
The film is billed as an intimate portrayal of what it means to be a young Native American in the 21st century. I don't know the first thing about what it means to be a young Native American, to be young anymore, young Native American, much less. If these three were any indication, it seems like a very confusing place to be. Is that wrong to say?
Yeah, I think it is confusing.
Can you explain some of the choices these three were facing at that time when this was shot?
The biggest choice is whether to stay or to leave the reservation. We're all pretty familiar with the fact that there's just not a lot of opportunity on many Indian reservations, and the Blackfeet Reservation is certainly no exception to that. However, when you commit to staying somewhere, then you start to build opportunity. That's the question, I think, for these three largely, is like, are we going to stay here, and are we going to deal with, you know, the fact that maybe it's going to be harder, or are we going to leave and go explore elsewhere and not come back to the reservation?
I don't want to give away how the film wraps up, but I kept asking myself, how are they even asking this question? What is there to stay for? Now, that is as a white outsider, but I kept asking myself, what's the question here?
Totally. You know, we've been editing this film for 3 years. We shot for half a year, and I was asking myself that question the whole time. I think that the answer to that question is, it's a deeper connection that is hard to explain in simple words. And I think that's the focus of the film, is to try to articulate that connection in some way. And that's why people choose to stay in that area, in these ancestral lands that they've lived on for, you know, thousands of years.
And that's the key word, Nico, ancestral, right? That's the key issue here. Our generation and what our kids will be raised on and what they'll know about our culture.
Yeah. That's totally it. You know, a lot of us come from immigrant families, and our sense of belonging is one or two generations. And that's strong already, you know. People identify strongly as Montanans. And I think that sense of place is like, I don't know, I'm fascinated by it. And I have it, and I long for it too. And I've lived in different countries now, and it's something that I deeply admire.
There was one moment that blew me away in there, and that involved the white driver of a cattle truck offloading some cattle into, admittedly, a pretty poor excuse for a shoot, and some of the cattle escape. And afterward, the driver tells Doug, the cowboy, that he should use some of the money to build a new shoot instead of on booze.
My advice, take some of that money and build a corral and shoot.
I was like, wait, did I just hear that correctly? Was that staged?
No, no, that really happened. That was really incredible. You know, the sound quality is not very good in that scene. But the guy just totally assumed that Doug was a drunk, and that's why the... And Doug doesn't drink, you know, he's totally against it, and he's... But yeah, I mean, and that's... Those are the kinds of stereotypes that I think that do permeate, you know, strongly into the minds of us white people, you know, about Indians.
Oh, it was not only just rude, it was, you know, as racist as can be, and it was grounds for a beatdown, frankly. And Doug, the cowboy, he was so soft-spoken and polite about it. His response shocked me almost as much as what the comment itself was.
Yeah, have a nice day.
Yeah, have a nice day. I don't drink. See you later.
Yeah.
And then it seemed to be kind of it. Did you talk about him after that scene had...
Yeah, we didn't talk about it that much.
Really?
I mean, that's how Doug is, you know? I think we sort of briefly mentioned, I said, oh man, Doug, that was crazy. And he said, yep, you know, people... He gets that all the time.
See,
he lives in a trailer up in Babb, Montana, you know? He gets that all the time. He's really good at dealing with it in a graceful way.
I can't wrap this up without mentioning the photography. You guys do the Montana landscape proud. Who is your director of photography? Explain that.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Thank you. Yeah, I shot it.
You did,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I went to film school, but certainly the art of cinematography is something that people should study, and I've been just kind of hacking my way through it. But I love that landscape over there, man. It's just beautiful. I love the way the light catches on the plains and hits the eastern mountain front, and I love the way the weather just gets stuck in the mountains, and it has a kind of aesthetic that I've never seen anywhere else.
Well, I've been speaking with Nicholas Hudak, the co-producer, co-director of Where God Likes to Be. It has its world premiere this Saturday at 5:30 at the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival. Is that at the Wilma?
Yeah, Wilma 1.
At the Wilma 1. And then also a screening in Browning later, right?
Yeah, yeah, we're screening in Browning on Monday.
Terrific.
So if anybody's around in Browning, please come along. We're at the community college there. I think we'll start at 6. We're going to have food and stuff beforehand and hang out and talk to people. So,
hey, terrific meeting you, and great movie. I loved it.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter weather advisory in effect from 5 a.m. tomorrow to 5 a.m. Friday for the Kootenai Cabinet region, the Lower Clark Fork region, the Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains, the West Glacier region, the Flathead Mission Valleys, the Missoula Bitterroot Valleys, and the Potomac Sealy Lake region. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with scattered snow showers with lows 13 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow, snow showers are likely with highs in the upper 20s to mid-30s. For central Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect until 8 p.m. this evening for the Hill, Shodo, Blaine, Judith Basin, and Fergus counties. There is a winter weather advisory in effect from 8 a.m. Thursday to 5 a.m. Friday for elevations above 4,500 feet for the Rocky Mountain front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow showers and lows 15 to 25 degrees. West wind gusts could reach up to 65 miles per hour. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of snow showers with highs 35 to 40 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow showers and lows 5 to 15 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow showers and highs 25 to 35 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Kohler.
Good evening. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, the area agency on aging for Missoula and Ravalli counties. Because next month is National Nutrition Month, tonight I would like to talk about senior hunger, Meals on Wheels, and the March for Meals campaign soon taking place. According to the Meals on Wheels Association of America, 1 in 6 older adults is threatened by hunger. A recent article in the Journal of Nursing notes about 60% of hospitalized older adults aged 65 and older are malnourished. Locally, the Missoula Food Bank client review showed that among all demographics served, the greatest increase in need has been with adults aged 55 and older. Our own research indicates that 65 to 70% of older adults served by Missoula Aging Services meal programs identify the food we provide as their most significant source of daily nutrition. The Meals on Wheels Association of America has created the month-long March for Meals initiative to raise the nation's awareness of senior hunger. Fixed incomes, social isolation, medical factors, and physical problems all contribute to this issue. Someone with limited income may have to forego the expense of major dental work because it isn't covered by Medicare. Poor oral health, physical impairment that make it difficult to eat, and declining ability to taste and smell also contribute to malnutrition in older adults. This leads to the risk of chronic disease in the elderly, diminishing their ability to live independently and increasing the overall cost of health care. March for Meals provides a time for education about senior hunger and also aims to encourage communities to support local Meals on Wheels programs. Last year, Missoula Aging Services Meals on Wheels served 95,800 meals to 765 homebound seniors throughout the county, including Seeley Lake, Condon, Frenchtown, and Clinton. This is an increase of roughly 5,800 meals over the previous years. These meals are delivered by volunteer drivers who also provide a friendly check-in, often the only contact clients have with another person all day, and just as important as the meal itself. Receiving this meal service is one support that helps older adults remain in their own homes, thereby helping keep healthcare costs down. The faces of our clients vary, with many over the age of 80 or 90. They may be widowed and living alone, or a couple aging together, but with chronic health problems that make it difficult to cook. Often a client may be uncomfortable with the idea of someone coming into their home to prepare a meal. Receiving Meals on Wheels is a less intrusive way of introducing supportive services, and from there, others can be offered to help a person remain at home. The number of baby boomers needing Meals on Wheels is rising among those with significant long-term care health issues. Someone just discharged from the hospital with a diagnosis of diabetes or heart disease benefits from the special diet Meals on Wheels can offer, while learning new diets they can eventually prepare themselves. Meals on Wheels even serves short-term needs, such as when a person gets the flu and feels too weak to cook. All of these reasons, along with the increasing population of older adults, add up to a higher risk of senior hunger and an escalating need for the program. What specific steps can you take during the March for Meals to help end senior hunger? Begin by making a donation to your local Meals on Wheels program, which needs support from the community to be sustainable. In Missoula County, we have to raise over $100,000 each year to prevent cuts in our program. Without grants and your generosity, we would have to start a waiting list. You can also volunteer. Many areas are always in need of volunteer drivers, including Missoula and Ravalli counties. Refer neighbors and friends who are isolated, no longer drive, or struggle to prepare their own nutritious meal. You'll find Meals on Wheels programs across the state, although some go by a different name. Finally, with midterm elections fast approaching, you can take this opportunity to let our congressional and state delegation know how important these programs are. The consequences of not providing financial support mean increased overall costs of health care and force many expensive options like nursing home placement. A collective effort by Montana citizens can help the Meals on Wheels Association of America and our state fulfill the goal of ending senior hunger by the year 2020. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, and as always, thanks for listening.
Susan Kohler is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.